So good afternoon. I'm going to talk to all of you about the question, how expensive does an alcohol intervention in Kenya need to be in order to deliver a favorable value? And I'm going to start by really thanking the tremendously wonderful group of people who've worked on this project, especially Kim Nusafora, Jason Kessler, without whom the work would not be possible. So by way of introduction, HIV remains a major cause of preventable morbidity and mortality in Kenya. So on a yearly basis, there are approximately 100,000 new infections per year and 61,000 deaths per year that are attributable to HIV. And also, as many of you know, Kenya has one of the highest rates of unhealthy alcohol use, approximately 30% among men. And some of our modeling work has estimated that alcohol is responsible for 13% of the new HIV infections in Kenya. However, alcohol remains absent from programming in HIV and substance use in that region. And part of the reason may be that the benefits of increased alcohol screening and treatment must be balanced against the benefits of alternative resource uses for those same quantities. So, for example, if a program isn't starting everybody on antiretroviral therapy very early or does not have sufficient funds in order to do routine virological monitoring, is it a better use of resources to use them for alcohol screening and treatment? That is an important question. So our objective was to use a validated computer simulation of the HIV epidemic in Kenya to estimate the cost effectiveness of a culturally tailored Kenyan alcohol intervention. So this intervention was a cognitive behavioral therapy-based, culturally tailored intervention that was developed by Becky Pappas. And in a randomized controlled trial, its effect was an increase in abstinence rates of approximately 45%. It was tested in the field in Kenya after it was adapted. The cost is really unknown, especially in the context of what would the cost be if it were scaled up. But it almost certainly is in the range of $1 to $50 per person, and most likely between $1 and $10 per person. So the scenario that we examined in the computer simulation was scaled up alcohol screening and application of this particular intervention versus routine care. The computer simulation that we used for this analysis represents HIV transmission as well as progression. Now, the reason why that's important is because lowering viral load through better adherence is not only good for the person whose viral load is lowered because their CD4 trajectory improves and they will live longer, but it's also important for other people because as their viral load goes down, they're less likely to transmit by 10 to 100-fold. And our simulation is able to capture both effects, both the effect on progression and the effect on transmission. And this simulation has been validated based on Kenyan HIV-infected cohorts and East African epidemiological data. In accord with a literature review of published data, alcohol was assumed to increase non-adherence and risk behaviors, in particular ART non-adherence by a risk ratio of 2.33 for doses not taken as directed, condom non-use with a risk ratio of 1.72, and STI prevalence with a risk ratio of 1.29. The methods that we used to assess costs were consistent with those recommended by the panel on cost effectiveness in health and medicine. We used a societal perspective. We used the longest time horizon that we thought would be credible for decision makers, 20 years. We used a discount rate of 3%. And just as a reminder to everybody, the discount rate is not the same as an inflation rate. What the discount rate does is it reflects time preference, the fact that a society or a person in general would rather get something now rather than an equivalent thing later. So it's on top of the inflation rate. Costs are inflated to 2012 U.S. dollars, and the outcome that we looked at was the incremental cost effectiveness ratio. And you may recall that earlier, I argued that because resources are constrained, what's important is not necessarily the incremental cost effectiveness ratio in a vacuum, but how the incremental cost effectiveness ratio compares to that of simultaneously resource-constrained decisions. So, in particular, those of starting ART earlier, say following the World Health Organization recommendation of 500 rather than 350, or even considering instantaneous initiation versus 500, as that may be where they're going. And also thinking about other simultaneous resource-constrained decisions, such as frequency or routine virological monitoring, and also availability of salvage therapy. So if the ICER of the alcohol intervention is lower is good, than the other resource-constrained interventions, it means that if you were to fund more in the way of alcohol interventions, even if you took money away from some of these other sources, you save more lives, you generate more population health. Whereas a numerically higher incremental cost-effectiveness ratio, which isn't as good, means that if you were to reallocate resources towards the alcohol intervention, it might actually not be as good for the population. One important caveat, which I'll mention now, even though it's not yet limitations time, is that the model only considers the alcohol intervention's effect on transmitting and treating HIV. It doesn't consider any of the other ill effects of alcohol, such as trauma and motor vehicle accidents and other diseases. So results are that a scaled-up, culturally tailored alcohol intervention could reduce alcohol-related infections from 13% down to 9%. It could add 138,000 life years and add 169,000 quality-adjusted life years. And a quality-adjusted life year is a life year that's weighted for quality, where a year only counts as a full year if it's a really good year lived in near perfect health. I'm going to show you a couple of these graphics, so I'll take a little bit of time on this first slide to orient you to them. So on the vertical axis, you have the incremental cost-effectiveness ratio, which is a metric that you've heard quite a bit about already, also called the ICER. So it's how much it costs to add an additional year of high-quality life to population health. And higher numbers are worse, and lower numbers are better. What we would love to do is to just give lots of help to everybody at virtually no cost. That would be the best scenario, and that corresponds to lower down on the vertical axis. Now, on the axis going from front to back, you have the intervention effect size. Now, we baked in that sensitivity analysis to all the figures that I'm showing you because the effect size of 45% that we use is our base case assumption regarding PAPIS's intervention. It's unclear if that effect size would be preserved if it were scaled up. It might get worse, it might get better. And so towards the front of the graph, that's the scenario in which the effect size would not be as great if the intervention were scaled up. And towards the back of the graph, that's the effect size that you get if the intervention were had effectiveness that were improved. And from left to right is an aggregate measure that requires a little bit of explanation. So that's a metric that captures the extent to which alcohol impacts all the effects that we think it has in the model based on our literature review, namely decreasing adherence to antiretroviral therapy, increasing STI prevalence, and increasing unprotected sex. And the reason why we varied that is because since all that data is based on observational studies and in sometimes C-level evidence, it's often questioned by people whether the effect sizes that we have in our model, even though they are most consistent with the literature, whether they're really the best ones. So as you go from left to right, on the right, you have a more certain impact of alcohol on those risk behaviors. To the left, you have less certain. And in the middle is our base case assumption. So if you want our base case, just go to the middle from left to right, and the middle from front to back, find the area on the surface, and look at the incremental cost-effectiveness ratio. And if you're feeling very pessimistic, look towards the front on the left, and if you're feeling very optimistic, look towards the right on the back. The surface has it all. So when the intervention costs $50 per person, what you can see is that the surface only starts to go down below $100,000 per quality if the effect size is greater and if there's more assumed effect of alcohol use on unsafe sex, ART adherence, and also on STI prevalence. It's very hard to get the surface down in the range of $0 to $20,000, as you can see by that tiny sliver that occupies the most optimistic corner. And $20,000 as an ICER is less favorable than the ICER of simultaneously resource-constrained decisions that I was discussing before. Those have ICERs in the range of $1,000 to $5,000 per quality. Now, What if the alcohol intervention, when scaled up, had a cost per person of $10? So now it's easier to make the surface drop down from that the higher ICERs. In fact, it's fairly easy to make it drop down from $20,000 per quality. Still, though, you have to have fairly optimistic assumptions in order to get it into that range that I was just describing, the range of $0 to $5,000 per quality, which is the range that you would get if you were to invest the same funds in alternative uses, namely in food monitoring, more regimens of antiretroviral therapy, and earlier therapy. What happens if it costs $1 per person? At that point, it does become favorable compared to other undisputed good sources of investment, such as earlier ART and additional rounds of salvage therapy for people who are failing. So there, it's fairly robust that even across a wide range of assumptions regarding how the effect size may change upon scale of the intervention, and also upon the particular base case estimate of alcohol's impact on non-adherence, STI prevalence, also condom non-use, it would offer extremely favorable value at a cost of $1 per person or less. So, limitations. Once again, this analysis only considers the impact of alcohol mediated through HIV transmission and progression. It doesn't consider trauma and other ill effects of alcohol, both health-mediated and otherwise. All models are subject to structural and parameter uncertainty. However, we definitely put this model through tons of tests to try and make sure that it predicts well, because we could produce incidence, prevalence, HIV death, survival, and CD4 trajectories of people in care in Kenya. And it could be argued that the scaling assumptions we made are unsophisticated. If you want to have a very, very nuanced scaling analysis, what you do is you reflect the fact that as you start to expand the intervention, initially the cost is high, then the cost per unit of expansion becomes lower because of economies of scale, and then it becomes higher at the very end. So it would look like an S-shape turned 90 degrees. Now, we didn't do that because we didn't think we would be able to really guess the right contours of the S, no matter how hard we tried. So that's why we did very broad sensitivity analyses that I showed you, and that's why we were looking at surfaces instead of simple curves. In conclusion, an alcohol intervention for HIV-infected Kenyans may well offer favorable value if the cost is $1 per person or less. And at that cost, it would add more health benefit than if funds were spent on alternative resource-constrained goals, such as earlier ART. Now, our future work is to ask, is there a targeting strategy that would enable the alcohol intervention to give greater value? So, for example, what if instead of giving the intervention to all users of alcohol, it were targeted specifically to binge drinkers who had detectable viral loads? That would likely dramatically improve the incremental cost-effectiveness ratio, and we are working on that very analysis. And then future work will also involve a more realistic model of scale-up that has that 90 degrees rotated S-shape that I was talking to you about. But we need to do a bit more homework before we really think that we know the contours of that S very well. So with that, I conclude. Thank you. Any questions? Yes?
Can you describe the intervention a little bit? Is it for the general population? Is it particular for drinkers?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So I'll start off by saying, because I didn't develop the intervention, I don't have the intimate knowledge of it that Becky Pappas does have, but it's based in cognitive behavioral therapy. It's 12 sessions. It's a group-based intervention, and Dr. Pappas is of the view that probably a lot of the beneficial effect did come from the group dynamic in addition to the actual content. And the initial intent was not to focus it on people who had alcohol use disorders, but in the study, the initial intention was not to focus it on people who had alcohol dependence. But because drinking levels are so high in the sample, that Dr. Pappas was enrolling from, she ended up getting a surprisingly high proportion of enrollees that were alcohol dependent. Yes, Bob.
If you think about the limitation of not including other alcohol-related outcomes, I guess in your mind, what proportion of alcohol-related outcomes are just HIV transmission versus all those other things, including potentially early death from other causes?
That's a great question. You know, that's a question that when we started our simulation wasn't that important because so many people were dying of AIDS, whereas now it's increasingly important. And so, in fact, just yesterday, I had a big meeting with my team and we went over what we term our competing risk generator. So the next version of the model is going to have this engine, if you will, that has the top 15 to 20 causes of morbidity and mortality that are population specific, along with alcohol's impact on them. So we will actually be able to address that very question, even though I don't know the answer this minute. Yes? Right. So that's a terrific question. So how are we navigating the causality issue? You know, it certainly is true that there aren't experimental studies that show that alcohol consumption reduces HIV-related morbidity and mortality. So at some level, it'll always come down to that. I think it's more if you believe that there is a causal relationship between alcohol consumption and unsafe sex and adherence that corresponds to the association that you see, then these results would be valid. If you think it's completely spurious, then the results would not be valid.